This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Welcome to you. When 26-year-old Tyler Keeling first got hired at Starbucks, he thought he'd struck gold. He was earning 13 bucks an hour.
I felt like I was making so much money at Starbucks when I first got hired as a 19-year-old.
Keeling loved that Starbucks was a community hangout. He had regulars, customers who would come by just to see him. But during the pandemic, his outlook changed. Business surged. Drink orders stacked up. He'd been with Starbucks for 6 years, and he didn't always feel listened to when he expressed concerns at work.
Beyond, like, any measure, I kind of just stopped feeling like I had a place in the company, other than being exploited.
Exploited? By Starbucks? The company that offers healthcare and education benefits to its part-time employees? Yeah, he said exploited. And it's not just Keeling who's feeling that way. In the last 3 months, baristas at more than 200 Starbucks coffee shops have filed petitions to unionize, including right here in Southern California. Today, KCRW's Robin Estrin introduces us to some local baristas brewing up a change in their industry.
At the start of the pandemic, Tyler Keeling was making $18 an hour at Starbucks. Part-time, that was just enough to cover gas, groceries, and rent in the two-bedroom apartment he shares with three people.
Like, I have to schedule and plan out really far in advance if I'm going to, you know, order a meal with somebody.
Keeling says Starbucks gave him a raise in October 2021 and another this January, but it wasn't enough to compete with inflation. He says the store where he worked in Lakewood was understaffed, and as the pandemic dragged on, he was feeling increasingly miserable at work.
There was never kind of like an adequate compensation that amounted to the amount of physical, emotional stress that the job presented me with. And I just got really worn out on every level of my existence to the point where even my personal life was so deeply affected that I didn't really have a personal life anymore.
He was thinking of quitting, but then, in December, a Starbucks in Buffalo, New York, became the first in the country to unionize. A union, Keeling thought. He didn't have a financial cushion or much security.
You know, I lose my job, I lose my housing, I lose my benefits, I lose my school, I lose health insurance, I lose my ability to feed me and my partner, I lose everything, all because I can't meet the whims of a company. And, like, all of that really is just so terrifying to me, and the only way to stave that off is unionization.
But Keeling worried leading a union drive at his store could bring about his worst fear, losing his job and paycheck. Starbucks has illegally fired employees involved in union organizing, according to complaints filed by the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB. An Arizona store manager who was fired, Brittany Harrison, had roots in Long Beach and was a friend of Keeling's. A Starbucks spokesperson said that the company fully respects the right of employees to organize and is, quote, committed to following the NLRB's process. However, the same spokesperson said that from Starbucks' perspective, the company is, quote, better together as partners without a union between us. One night in February, Keeling made a fake Twitter account to surreptitiously engage with union content. Then he got a call from a coworker, or in Starbucks lingo, a partner. Yeah, the company calls baristas partners.
Like, what do you think about all this? I'm interested in hearing your point of view. And that's when that partner told me, like, I actually want to do this. And I was like, me too, so let's go.
Keeling sent an email to the newly minted union representing baristas in Buffalo, Starbucks Workers United. The next day, he got a call from an organizer with the group, and the race to unionize his store was on. 1 month later, the Lakewood store and another store in Long Beach filed petitions with the NLRB announcing their intention to unionize. Since then, several more stores in Southern California have followed suit, in Anaheim, Little Tokyo, at a Starbucks in Disneyland. They're part of a wave, and a winning one. Of more than 40 Starbucks stores across the country that have held elections so far, all but two have voted to unionize.
Well, it's been a remarkable campaign.
That's San Francisco State University professor John Logan. He says there hasn't been a union drive so successful since the 1940s. This wave, Logan says, is powered by baristas disillusioned by work during the pandemic. Revenue for the Starbucks Corporation shot up 24% from 2020 to 2021, where it teetered near $30 billion. Meanwhile, workers toiled away with little to show for it.
For 2 years, their jobs have gotten harder, more stressful, more dangerous. They don't feel that they've been rewarded adequately. In many cases, they don't feel that they've been treated with respect. And so they view getting, an independent voice, getting a seat at the bargaining table through Starbucks Workers United as a way of gaining that respect and gaining just treatment at work.
Logan says the union drive has been a success largely because it's been led by the baristas themselves, not professional union organizers. The same was true for the employees who organized the country's first Amazon union in Staten Island last month. A national union called Workers United is supporting the baristas' effort, but from the backseat. Here's lead organizer Fernando Hernandez.
I am there to help out and guide partners in Starbucks to organize. But I mean, in reality, it's them themselves, helping each other, coming together to do this.
Hernandez, who has helped Keeling and other baristas in California get the movement off the ground, says he's never seen a campaign like the one underway at Starbucks. He actually has a word for it.
That's the magic, right? We call it the magic, right? Here in Starbucks, it's workers themselves leading this successful campaign.
Not without pushback from the corporation, which has invested heavily in beating back the wave, hiring
an army of lawyers from the biggest management side employment law firm in the country, Lidler Mendelsohn, which has over 1,000 attorneys in the United States, over 1,500 globally. And Lidler, since its founding in the 1940s, has always specialized in going up against unions.
Baristas at Starbucks shops in California and New York told KCRW the company has been posting anti-union messages in employee break rooms and holding required meetings where workers say managers are using ambiguously threatening language to dissuade them from unionizing.
Somebody maybe from management will come in and say, hey, it's a possibility that if you vote for the union, you won't be able to transfer stores anymore. And then some partners will be scared and be like, wait, I didn't know that. And it's actually not true.
That's Josie Serrano, a barista who's worked side by side with Keeling to help organize the union effort in Long Beach. Serrano says Starbucks' anti-union campaign is not working.
Whatever Starbucks gives us, a lot of us were just kind of like, okay, this is taken with a grain of salt immediately.
The Starbucks spokesperson told KCRW, quote, "We respect the union's right to share information, and it's our right to share information as well." But it's an uphill battle for the corporation, says Logan, the labor professor. He says Starbucks doesn't understand its employees and how they've been changed by the pandemic.
They're very determined. Some of them have been politicized long before the union campaigns by participation in Black Lives Matter, by participation in, Me Too, environmental justice movements, Bernie Sanders presidential campaigns. So they're young workers who are very politically aware. Union message resonates with them. And, they're taking the lead in these campaigns.
Starbucks is operating with a stick and a carrot. As the company wages its campaign against the union, it's also paying up to reduce the need for one. Last October, during the union push in Buffalo, the corporation announced a $1 billion infusion into employee wages, raising the average hourly pay to $17 an hour. Baristas don't deny that a meaningful raise would be great. But Keeling says the company is missing the point.
A good workplace is just a snapshot in time. There is nothing stopping that workplace, unless it's a union workplace, from going downhill. You could work at the best store in the world, the best place in the world. You could love your job in every aspect of it. And in 6 months, some policy changes and your work life is suddenly the worst thing it could be, right? What's preventing that change?
Real partners, Keeling says, have a voice, a seat at the table. And to him, that means a union. Baristas at his store in Lakewood and at Serrano's store in Long Beach have until May 13th to vote whether to become the first unionized Starbucks stores in Southern California. For KCRW, I'm Robin Estrin.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotake is here. And the University of California says it'll be waiving tuition for Native American students. That is good news for some, but there are requirements that students have to meet to qualify for that. The main one being that the student has to be a member of a federally recognized tribe. Problem is, getting federal recognition is really tough. It can take decades, and a lot of tribes have never even received it. Kimberly Morales Johnson is the tribal secretary for the Gabrielino Tongva San Gabriel Band of Mission Indians and a PhD student at UC Davis. She joins me now to talk about it. Kimberly, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What is the reason that UC is doing this, do you think? This is obviously for access, right?
Right. I also think that the UC system knows about land grabs and land grants, and a lot of the land that the UC system sits on was part of the taking of the land from the indigenous people throughout the state of California. And so I feel that this is a way of moving forward for them.
A lot of Native American students don't apply to college or university because it's too expensive, obviously. Could this make a big difference in the number who apply, the number of Native American students who actually go on to college?
I certainly hope so. I think that that is definitely something that people can strive for, federally recognized students looking forward to, oh, now we can go to school and we don't have to pay the tuition. It relieves a barrier. So I believe that there will be more applications and hopefully people will be coming back to school.
Have you heard any response to the program, you know, from tribes or even from students who qualify?
There's a lot of confusion right now. I'm not going to lie. I'm in the Native American Studies program up here at UC Davis, as you stated. And so there are individuals who are here, like maybe from the Navajo Reservation, and they are part of a federally recognized tribe. And part of the stipulation is you have to establish residency within the state of California. So they're still in that process of establishing residency, but they definitely want to so that they can get their tuition waiver. But for us that are non-federally recognized, we were very happy to hear that Greg Zaris up in Northern California with the Grafton Rancheria, he's offered a $2.5 million fund that non-federally recognized tribal students can apply for. So it will be more of a competitive process. And so we're still trying to wait to hear some more information about that new program.
Do you think that seems like a significant step, though, to fill the void for many of these students who may not qualify or maybe are having a hard time figuring all this out?
Right, absolutely. And I do. I feel like for me, it's definitely a possibility to apply. But I'm an older student, and so definitely my children. And for the generations to come, I think that once things get rolling, I believe removing the barrier of cost will help to encourage more and more students to go to school.
Let's talk a little bit about the sticky part of this, because there are a lot of Native American tribes in Southern California. There are no federally recognized tribes in LA, Ventura, or even Orange counties. So a lot of potential students won't be eligible from right here at home in the greater LA area. What do you do about that? I mean, again, as I mentioned at the outset, it's really difficult to become federally recognized.
Right. And even up here in Northern California, but, you know, my tribe is LA. And so let's first talk about the cost of land in Los Angeles and Orange County and Ventura County. Those are probably one of the most, you know, expensive counties within the whole entire United States. So is it a surprise that none of us are federally recognized? Not really.
You're saying this is a real estate problem.
Well, this was, you know, back when California became a state in 1850 in the 1900s, they knew where the ports were going to be, San Francisco and LA. And so they did not federally recognize any of those tribes.
Are people in those tribes, the ones that are having difficulties getting federal recognition, are they speaking up? Are they
talking more about this? Are they mentioning this, the land issue?
I think that as time, well, my tribe has been fighting for federal recognition ever since, you know, the mission period and all before that. We were happy and we were safe. Then when they started to implement processes with the development of the BIA, the development of different organizations,
BIA?
The Bureau of Indian Affairs. So they are the ones who put the stipulations on the tribes, and they were the ones who said, oh, yeah, well, you definitely have a relationship and ongoing relationships with the tribe. But for the Gabrielino Tongva people, and I think for other people, for us, I know for a fact that we had an Indian agent that came out to Southern California, and he would report back to the government about the state of affairs for Native Americans. And this happened throughout the state. There were Indian agents throughout the state. And he was supposed to buy us a reservation up at Fort Tejon. However, the story is either he squandered the money or he never bought the reservation, and therefore we were not recognized. So we started to work more. We always had a relationship with like the Department of Interior back in the 1960s and 70s, and they were developing Los Angeles. My dad, my uncles, my family members were the most likely descendants. And so they would contact them and say, we found ancestral remains. What should we do with them? And then we started to see things like the Native American Heritage Commission was developed. And then there was more of a process, more process, more process. We applied for federal recognition multiple times. And in, I think it was the year 2002, Hilda Solis, she opened up a bill, H.R. 2619, to try to get us federal recognition. And the day that it was supposed to go in front of Congress or whoever it was, the next day was September 11th. So it was 2001.
Wow.
And so all the bills got shelved at that time.
Yeah, Hilda Solis, who is the supervisor here in L.A. County, she used to be in Congress. She was a representative. Talk a little bit, Kimberly, about your own experience. You're a PhD student, right, at UC Davis. How does this affect you?
So first, I think it's important to say that, you know, after years of what happened to our people in Los Angeles and throughout the state of California with the gold rush and everything else, I am a first-generation college student, and I am over 50 years old, and I didn't plan it to be this way. I was a teacher, and I was okay with that. But as time goes on, started to learn more things and to have a voice, I know that I need to have more of an academic training. So I came back to school. I quit my tenured teaching job last June, and I came up here, and I have a small apartment in Davis. I still have a home in L.A., and I go back and forth often. So for me, if the tuition is waived, that would be, you know, a huge barrier for me and my family so that I can continue with my studies. However, now that I know I'm going to have to apply for, you know, a competitive process, I'm still going to look for other sources of funding. I'm not going to stop what I'm doing. I'm going to keep looking for sources of funding so that I can continue with the work that I'm doing.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on and talking with us about it. Kimberly Morales Johnson, the tribal secretary for the Gabrielino Tongva San Gabriel Band of Mission Indians, PhD student up at Davis. Kimberly, thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
This is Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and on to two iconic artists now at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. The Lee Alexander McQueen exhibition pairs designer clothes with museum objects, and artist Barbara Kruger plays with text and pop culture and video installations in rooms covered in vinyl. To tell us more about these shows at LACMA, our art insider Lindsay Preston Zappas is here, founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
All right, I want to start with the Alexander McQueen exhibit. As I mentioned, the pieces are paired with objects from the museum's collection. Were there any, I don't know, any standout pairing, something that really caught your eye?
Oh, Oh, man, there's so many. I mean, what was so brilliant about the show is it really focused on Alexander McQueen's kind of inspirations across art and culture. So you really saw that with kind of the pairings that they selected from their collection. You know, there was this Alexander McQueen collection from 2007 that focused on McQueen's distant relatives who he found out were actually executed in the Salem witch trials. And he made these gowns that had this beautiful, just so beautiful beadwork down the front that almost looks like long locks of hair. And this was in reference to how accused women in the witch trials, their hair was often cut off. And, you know, but the design could also speak to fire or women being burnt at the stake. So there's a lot of symbolism there. And then these gowns were paired with Ernst Barlach prints from 1922, which really played with similar themes. So again, you really get a sense of how deeply McQueen was influenced by historical narratives and kind of visual culture.
And not only is it a visual exhibit, Lindsay, but it's also one that you can hear, right, with a soundtrack.
I know.
I mean, how does that work? And did you listen as you walk through? I mean, how does that even happen?
Yeah, I did not do my homework ahead. I didn't know this would be an element. So sadly, I did not have headphones with me. But there is a sign they encourage guests not to bother people and play it out loud, but to wear headphones as you're walking through the exhibition.
Yeah.
But I listened when I got home and it was great. The soundtrack was created by two members of Dub Lab here in LA. So Barbara Salazar and Alejandra Cohen. And really inspired by music that McQueen would play for his runway shows. And again, kind of encapsulating some of the drama of his designs and kind of the shifting influences and shifting styles.
Let's move on to Barbara Kruger's exhibition. It's called Thinking of You, I Mean Me, I Mean You.
Yeah.
Which is a play on words. And that play in the title is something that the artist, you know, shows through the exhibition. Tell us how Barbara uses words or phrases in her work.
Yeah, I mean, she's so good at this. She's really well known for typed out statements that often appear in Helvetica or Futura font over a red background over like a grayscale image. You've seen this, even if you don't know you've seen it. So an iconic example is "I shop, therefore I am," or "Your body is a battleground," which of course that piece feels so just like timely and prescient right now, given, you know, the leak of the Supreme Court decision on abortion rights. But, you know, the text across her work really plays with cultural systems of capitalism, consumerism, power, gender, and sexuality. And she really plays with text in a way that kind of questions these things. And even that title, you're seeing her kind of flip the words and it becomes this kind of poetic wordplay. And again, you know, her style is so iconic that it's really informed a whole visual style across our culture. For instance, the streetwear brand Supreme, their logo is like directly ripped off of her aesthetic. And, you know, the first room in her installation at LACMA, she actually addresses this, where she collaged a bunch of images that, you know, were sourced from different posters and flyers and streetwear brands and t-shirts that directly kind of utilize her style. So it was really interesting to see her kind of like directly reference all of that and to see the profound ripple effect that her work has had on visual culture.
I mean, this work, by the way, is really visual and kind of in your face. I mean, bright colors, the bold letters and font, the images. She mixes media and uses everything from advertising to propaganda to social media. I mean, was there something that caught your eye, something that you were like, wow?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm so familiar with her imagery and her text work, but it was really interesting to see her work kind of across an exhibition like this and to see some of the mechanisms that she uses to really draw the viewer in. So one example of that was a video piece that included, again, that iconic work, "Your Body is a Battleground." And the image was installed in this way, kind of set into the wall as a video. And in the piece, the video image kind of breaks down into these puzzle pieces that slowly get reassembled. And then once the image is back together, the text shifts and these other phrases come in that are really playful. So it goes from your body is a battleground to my body is money to your body is a piece of fruit. My coffee is a motorboat. Your will is bought and sold. So I love that motorboat one because it gets so kind of absurdist. But at the same time, she's saying like my body is money. Your body is a piece of fruit. Like will is bought and sold. So it's both funny, but also poetic and actually really profound and political. So it's just great to see how kind of she animates her ideas in real time using video and sound and, you know, these kind of dynamic plays over time.
Really sounds cool. The McQueen exhibition is up through October 9th, so we've got a few months for that. Barbara Kruger is up through July 17th, both at LACMA right now. Lindsay Preston Zappas, founder and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, as always, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Join us tomorrow. You're going to hear students and kids talking about the climate crisis. It is a motivating issue. It is a political issue and something that is making waves all across the country and around the world. Hear that tomorrow right here on GLA. Join us online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Hear any story from this radio program and podcast and get that podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Again, at our new KCRW website, complete with new logo and brand refresh, kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Rebecca Ludman, Juliana Mayo, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all helped with this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chitakis, honored by your presence tonight. Have yourself a great night.